Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of April. 6 months ago, Harvard University rejected calls to divest from fossil fuels. Earlier this month, Harvard signed on to a UN-backed Code of Responsible Investment, which means the $33 billion endowment will be guided by a set of investment principles, and those will take into account environmental factors. But the guidelines do not commit Harvard to selling existing holdings in fossil fuels. This hour, we will be talking about a letter that made news on April 10. It was signed by many members of the faculty of Harvard University and sent to the president. Our university invests in the fossil fuel industry. It states, "This for us is the central issue. We now know that fossil fuels cause climate damage and change, unprecedented destructive potential. We also know that many in this industry spend large sums of money to mislead the public, deny climate science, control legislation and regulation, and suppress alternative energy sources." They go on to state, it's a long letter, that they were disappointed in the statements on divestment that had been made, and they were calling for divestment on the part of Harvard University. This hour, we'll have two guests with us. Dr. James Recht is one of the principal authors of the letter to the Harvard president. He is chair of the Massachusetts chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, a staff psychiatrist at Cambridge Hospital, teaches at Harvard Medical School, and received his medical degree from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Later in the hour, the program director for Citizens Climate Lobby, a national organization whose mission is to lobby members of Congress for enactment of a revenue neutral carbon tax. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. We always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Dr. James Recht, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. So Harvard took one step. 6 months ago, they said, forget the whole issue. Then they said earlier in the month, we're going to be responsible, and that includes environmentally responsible. But you and many faculty members believe it's not going quite far enough.
Yes, that's right. We felt that the measures that they announced earlier this month are not adequate. They don't measure up to the severity and urgency of the crisis.
So who signed this letter? It's a really strong letter signed by quite a few faculty members.
Yes. Well, we began working on this letter in December or January, and initially there were five of us. We were, in a way, sort of brought together by Dr. Eric Shivian, who is a... I'm sort of proud to say he's a psychiatrist himself by training, but has over recent years really devoted himself to working on making the science about climate change meaningful and understandable to human beings in a way that can help motivate people to make necessary changes. Mm-hmm. And for anybody who's interested, I'd recommend I'm going to give you a URL if that's okay.
Sure, that's fine.
This is the website of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard School of Public Health, where Dr. Shivian was was there for many years. I believe he helped found it, and it was there until just recently. And that's at CHGE. Center for Health and Global Environment, chge.med.harvard.edu.
Okay.
And that site gives an excellent set of examples of the type of work that he's done. Again, not to go out too far off topic, but Dr. Shivian and his colleagues initially, years ago, achieved notoriety. They actually won the Nobel Prize as part of a different organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility, but probably one of your callers will correct me if I'm wrong about that, but I believe it was Physicians for Social Responsibility, that did the initial research on the potential consequences of a nuclear battle or nuclear war. And they focused on the same principles back then, which was to take the science that in itself risks just overwhelming people or turning people off or resulting in a kind of cognitive numbing, and interpreting or presenting that information in a way that normal human beings can really understand.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of talking about kilotons of energy, they talked about how many people, for example, would suffer first-degree burns, second-degree burns, third-degree burns in a typical nuclear battle. And by making that information real to people, they were able, they played a big role in the kind of ramping down, at least the temporary ramping down of the, you know, nuclear arms race. So he and people like him are really trying to do the same type of thing with climate science now.
And what you've asked for is for Harvard to divest from industries that contribute to global warming, to divest from fossil fuel.
Yes, and again, here I'm going to be speaking for myself as a health professional, and I couldn't begin to speak for Eric, as eloquent as he is, or even for the colleagues that I work together with, because we're all individuals. We all come from, you know, different academic
sure.
disciplines. We have different emotional reasons for doing this and different ethical standards. But to me, in the interest of clarity here, what is crystal clear about this problem is that we are taking too much coal out of the ground and injecting too much coal into the atmosphere. And as the chief editors of the British Medical Journal just wrote in their most recent issue, this is an amazing article that I'd also recommend people go to. You just go to bmj.org and look at the most recent issue. They state, this is an emergency, quote unquote. This is an emergency. Immediate and transformative action is needed at every level, individual, local, and national, personal, political, and financial. And that, to me, is a very meaningful statement. And these are physicians like myself who wrote this, had the courage to write this article. They go on to say, so what can health professionals do? Firstly, they say we need to push our own organizations to divest from fossil fuel industries completely and as quickly as possible. And again, what that means is simply saying we're taking our money out of the companies whose business models depend on the continued extraction of carbon from the earth and its injection or transmission into the atmosphere. Harvard, earlier this month, to a great extent in response to the amazingly courageous and effective work the students are doing on campus, and they really deserve all the credit for that. We sort of wrote this letter inspired by them. But Harvard made this attempt to respond to the students' divestment demands by saying, you know, we don't think divestment's wise. At one point in the letter, the president characterized it as something in a, I personally felt it was kind of a dismissive way, sort of alluding to eureka or flash in the pan measures that Harvard felt that it sort of rose above,
mm-hmm.
Was the implication. But they again, you know, made clear that they're not willing to consider taking their money, discontinuing their financial support for the companies that take carbon out of the ground and put it into the air. And instead, they suggested that by joining these voluntary initiatives, one is the PRI, the Principles of Responsible Investment, that's the one that has some sort of UN backing, and the other is called the Carbon Disclosure Project, another voluntary purely voluntary initiative. Neither one of them requires any actual behavior change on the part of the of their subscribers or participants. That would somehow be an effective substitute, or in somehow or somehow constitute, an effective response or set of measures to get at the crisis that we're facing.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to say as clearly as possible, it is not. We're still waiting for Harvard to make clear that they are going to change in a way that's that measures up to the, like I say, the urgency of this problem.
Well, and it's put very succinctly, Doctor. The university, you write, either invests in fossil fuel corporations or it divests.
Yes, and I, one could argue back and forth about this, but in my opinion, and I would say to the, as far as the statements in our letter go. In the opinion of my colleagues that worked on this with me, it really is as simple as that. That's the decision that needs to be made right now.
You also go on to talk about, let me quote, Harvard's leadership initiated by faculty, students, and alumni is credited with making campaigns against apartheid and smoking far more effective. Those were divestment campaigns. Quite successful, weren't they?
They were. In fact, they were. There, some have suggested over the subsequent to the divestment around South African apartheid, some people have looked back and questioned whether Harvard could have gotten into the divestment movement a little bit sooner. But in any case, regardless of that, they did. They eventually did, and their participation in that movement was not the only. Obviously, it was not there was no single change or announcement that ended apartheid, but Harvard's participation had a great deal to do with moving it forward. And I just want to say, and absolutely with tobacco investment, Harvard played a significant role.
The letter talks about ethical responsibility. What does that mean to you?
Well, there are two levels of that, I think, or at least two aspects of that in this case, and I would just like to indicate for listeners one other resource, and that is a way to listen online to another speaker who, again, I think is much more eloquent than I am about this. That's Professor James Anderson, who was interviewed last week on Democracy Now! So if anybody goes to democracynow.org and looks for, I believe it was last Thursday's, it might have been last Friday's, installment that contains an interview of Dr. Anderson, who graciously, he's actually the first signer of our letter. He laid this out very clearly, but I'll try to summarize it. The ethics, I see it on two levels. One is, personally, for me, as a parent, as a father of two kids who are going to have to grow up in the world that, we leave to them, and as a professional, somebody who's pursued a career in the health sciences, what are my responsibilities? And to me, I'm not going to repeat the British Medical Journal's lead editorial, but I feel a great identification with that statement. It recognizes the severity of the emergency, and it states clearly what we as professionals have an obligation to do in response. But a whole other level is our responsibility as teachers. And again, as Dr. Anderson put in, I really would encourage people to get over to Democracy Now! To listen to that. We are in the, when we sign on as teachers, we take responsibility for helping our students understand how the world works. And it doesn't make sense for us to say to our students, look, here's the science, here's how it works. And then when they come back to us to say, we want to change that, to tell them, no, sorry, now you know how it works, but we're not in the business of cooperating with you or working with you to change it. I just think that's wrong. And I think when students as amazing as the ones at the Tufts campus out here in Massachusetts, University of Massachusetts, there are I've heard good things about the students at University of Wisconsin-Madison, but I'm sure there are lots of other college students out there in the Midwest doing great stuff. When they say to us, look, this is what we've learned from you, and this is what we understand needs to change, then we have a responsibility to listen to them and respect that. And I think that's another big part of it, and that's what we tried to communicate in our letter.
And finally, how has your letter been received?
Well, we did get a response from the president.
Oh, you did?
Of Harvard, yeah.
Huh.
It was brief, and it's on our website, harvardfacultydivest.org. We're crafting a response to it actually as we speak. But she and the fellows of the corporation essentially said, well, reasonable people can disagree on this. Thank you for your opinion. We got a very positive response from students all over the country, and I will say honestly, from other people who are active in the movement to save, you know, our climate. We got very supportive responses from, you know, climate activists and people in the know about these things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Dr. Recht, for being with us.
Again, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Dr. James Recht, he is chair of the Massachusetts Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, psychiatrist at Cambridge Hospital, instructor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. We're talking about the letter that was sent to the president of Harvard University from some 100 professors and staff people at the university looking at the fossil fuel investment in the fossil fuel industry on the part of the Harvard endowment and asking for the university to divest, that it is an act of ethical responsibility. They go on at great length to talk about the urgency, which cannot be overstated, humanity's reliance on burning fossil fuels leading to a marked warming of the Earth's surface, melting of ice the world over, rise in sea levels, and it goes on about the health consequences and loss of life as a result of climate change and the Earth becoming warmer. And as you heard Dr. Recht say, they had a rather short statement from the president of the university. Responsible people will disagree on this, but the movement at Harvard has moved the university to at least one step, which has been hailed by some environmentalists, and that is... We'll see what happens as a result of this letter and the growing movement. Our phone number, as we continue our conversation and talk about what citizens are doing in Wisconsin and actually all over the country, we'll continue our conversation and take phone calls for our new guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The program director for Citizens Climate Lobby, a national organization whose mission is to lobby members of Congress for enactment of a revenue-neutral carbon tax, will be with us. We'll also ask what her thoughts are about the divestment movement. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With us now is Madeline Parra, National Program Director for the Citizens Climate Lobby. This is a nonpartisan group devoted to building political support for decisive national climate protection legislation. They are urging Congress to enact a revenue-neutral federal carbon tax to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And they help ordinary people educate themselves about climate change and then become citizen lobbyists, writing and calling and meeting with local opinion leaders, members of Congress, members of the press, keeping the issue in front of them. Madeline has an interesting background here. We'll ask her to tell her story, what she did after she read climatologist James Hansen's book about the dangers of climate change. And we'll continue welcoming phone calls. We were talking about divestment and didn't take calls on that. Do you think that this is a movement that you would like to get behind? Would you like major universities and colleges to divest monies they may have in the fossil fuel industry, that it's ethically and scientifically the right thing to do, and that those kinds of divestments make a difference in changing policy? Madeline, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So you read James Hansen's book, and you changed your life.
That's true. It is an interesting story because I found his book on my mother's coffee table when I went home for Christmas, back in late in 2009 it was. And I started reading it, and I found that it was confirming my sense of urgency that I already had somewhat about climate change. And I was like, this guy's been studying it for decades and speaking out about it, and he's deeply concerned about what's going to happen to his grandkids and everybody else. So on the way home from Chicago, where my mom lived, my husband and I were talking, and we're like, if this is true, what are we going to do? It can't, you know, it, and it really called to us that we couldn't just lead our lives the way we had been and just, you know, be decent people, teaching, going to our jobs, raising our kids, but that we had to do something more than that. And I was a teacher at that time. It was winter break for us, and so I started researching on the Internet and figuring out, well, I'll follow what James Hansen says, since he knows more about it, and start in there. And step by step by step, I got more and more involved, and learned a great deal and found some great people to work with. And it's actually been a wonderful thing in my life to take this step.
Mm-hmm. So you're devoting your life to this in addition to your other responsibilities, but this is your mission.
Yeah. One of the things that the divestment movement does is raise this as a moral issue, like where should we be investing our money as institutions and elsewhere, and as an ethical issue. And for me, it spoke to that also. It's like, who am I going to be as a person in the face of this threat?
Mm-hmm. You heard, I'm sure, the doctor saying that this whole issue, because of the enormity of the issue, it can lead to a kind of numbing, that you feel it's so immense, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. You and your organization feels quite the opposite, that you do take steps all the time, and average people can do quite a bit.
Absolutely. One of the hallmarks of Citizens Climate Lobby is that we keep ourselves focused on solutions. We read the science, we know the science, we're concerned about that deeply, but we don't have to just read it and sit on the couch and get depressed. That there are, we can, as a society, figure this out and solve it. It really is about ordinary citizens insisting to their governments that they do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we help people do that.
And you also meet with editorial boards and with members of Congress quite regularly to let them know how concerned you are about this issue. Tell me about those meetings and how well received your concerns are.
Well, that's really interesting, because our view of Congress is so negative, mm-hmm, these days, and Congress is so polarized that you know, when I'm talking to people, I usually say, like, you know, you probably think we're crazy to focus on Congress, and they all laugh. But in fact, from being in these meetings, I've learned what might sound a little trite, but they're just people in there, and they are not stupid people, actually. That we've had many good meetings with conservatives, with Republicans, and in private, many of them are more understanding of the issue than they are in public. So what does that say, then? That you know, they're going to go where they think their constituents want them to go, because they want to get reelected. And if they're not hearing from us, they're not going to act. So that's the good news, in a way, because once we make it absolutely clear that we insist upon action, I believe we'll have that political tipping point and things will move.
And what action are you insisting on?
Well, you know, as Dr. Rep was saying, there's a lot of things that people can do personally, in their communities, in their states. What we looked for, so as not to get overwhelmed by the possibilities, was what could be the greatest leverage solution that we could go for. And economists are pretty agreed, actually, that if you shift the pricing structure of our energy system so that fossil fuels are not the cheapest default action, but you know, the sort of make the most economic sense when you're figuring out your life. But if you change that pricing so that non-fossil fuels, clean energy, is more cost-effective, then people will go that way. And there's a very simple way to do that, actually, which is to put a fee on the amount of carbon dioxide that is emitted by the fossil fuels. And we don't want to put a huge fee on right away, so start it low and move it up gradually but predictably so everybody knows what's happening. And that will, in fact, change our behavior, whether we believe in climate change or not. And so the economists, actually from the left and the right, agree on this. Like in one survey, like over 90% of them agreed that this would be the most effective thing we could do. And you wouldn't want to do that, you know, in a small community. You'd want to do that on a national level, and then you'd want other countries to adopt that too. So that was the highest leverage thing we could find, and so that's what we've thrown all our muscle and organizing behind.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Madeline Parra is our guest, National Program Director of the Citizens Climate Lobby. They are devoted to building political support for decisive national climate protection legislation. And as you heard her outline, they want Congress to enact a revenue-neutral federal carbon tax to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. They are regular people like we are, and they have educated themselves about climate change and become really citizen lobbyists. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Carl in Madison is our first caller, Madeline. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. I have two brief comments. One regarding the caller who was, or the speaker who was talking earlier about Harvard and the effort to divest there. When Nelson Mandela came to the United States after apartheid fell and said, you know, talked about what had helped that regime fall apart and a new way of living in South Africa happen, he said it was really the divestment issue. It was really people stepping away from the financial advantage of supporting something that was not in the common good, not in the public interest. And Bill McKibben has said, in the case of climate change, if it is wrong to destroy our atmosphere that we breathe, then it is wrong to profit from that destruction. So I'd like to first urge the University of Wisconsin, who did take a very active role in the divestment from apartheid, to take that role again on an issue that affects every human being across this globe. And second of all, I happen to know Madeline Parra. I don't think there is a person of greater integrity to be leading a climate change organization. I wanted to thank her publicly for her work. It seems to me that it's become these days more and more in politics in general that it is the truth versus money, and that where there's no money on our side of the issue, but there are the facts. There is the truth. And I was just curious, from Madeline's perspective, as she goes around the country and talks to folks, and as she works here in Madison to get this conversation really going and to energize people, what makes her the most hopeful about where the discussion is right now? And what energizes her to keep going in this fight as we all try to gather the steam to push this in the right direction?
Thank you, Carl.
And thanks for those kind words, Carl. I have like the best job in the world because I hear from people all over the country about the things that they're doing. And so really it's the volunteers in Citizens Climate Lobby, but also beyond that, that give me hope. I get emails from people about what they're doing to organize a new chapter, because we're doubling in size every year and should be up to 300 chapters by the end of the year. I get emails from people asking advice about what should they do in a particular meeting with a member of Congress, or just with their latest creative ideas. A group in California discovered there was a wine caucus within Congress, and so so they started to meet with them and say, well, you know, look what's going to happen to the wine. The drought in California is going to just completely destroy the grapes, and to try to invest some in something that they already cared about, those members of Congress. So those kinds of things, seeing the great diversity of action that is going on and that isn't always highlighted in the media, is what gives me hope and keeps me going.
You worked on divestment, didn't you, for some time?
I did. Here in Madison, through 350.org, we sponsored when Bill McKibben did his national tour. Mm-hmm. He came and kicked off the movement here, and it's been great to see that keep going and to see the students on campus take that over and really run with it.
Thanks, Carl, so much for your call. Dick in Madison is next. Hello, Dick.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I saw Years of Living Dangerously the other night, that Showtime series on climate change. And for the first time, I saw somebody, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, down in Texas, who was commenting, who was talking a lot with conservatives, with Republicans about climate change, and seemed to be really breaking through, particularly with evangelical Christians. And then I found out she's a member of the group, I think she's a member of the group that Madeline Perr is working with. And I guess I'm wondering, are Citizens Climate Lobby people, are they reaching out to Republicans, making an effort in that area?
Yes, we certainly are. In fact, that's actually one of our priorities, because the Democrats can't pass climate change legislation by themselves. It's going to take a bipartisan effort. And Republicans and Democrats both have to live on this planet. So a lot of what we do in Citizens Climate Lobby is figure out how can we bring them together. It's almost like matchmaking. So we may ask one supporter, can you reach out to another office? We may ask an aide in a Republican office, would you help us reach some other aides in either other Republican offices or the Democratic ones? And because behind the scenes, these folks work together. In fact, I was in a meeting with Paul Ryan once, and I was kind of joking about the fact that he had given us a second meeting in 4 months, but Representative Pocan, my own representative, hadn't done that. And Paul Ryan came to the defense of Representative Pocan, even though they're far apart politically. It's like there are relationships there that we try to build on so they can come together.
Good for you. All these things happening behind the scenes that we don't know about, right?
Exactly. And that's one of the advantages of getting involved, is that you start to find out these things, and it can leave you more hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say that I saw Dr. Hayhoe on that show also, Years of Living Dangerously, and she is, in fact, on our advisory board. She was so impressive, because she's a climate scientist. She studies drought. She's in Texas. And that's a great thing to study in Texas, given the drought they have. But she's also an evangelical Christian, and she's married to a pastor in the evangelical church.
Huh.
And what she is doing is talking to people around Texas about basically how you can be true to your faith and support action on climate change. And by being a model for that, she's moving people along that way.
Thank you so much, Dick, for your call. Let's go to Wayne and Holman next. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I sure like your guest. I think she sounds like a very reasonable lady. I'm a little more conservative than most, or conservative in many ways as some, but my question is, and I'm searching for answers, and I certainly agree with the guest that we need to do many things in this area of climate change. I support it as a conservative Republican. We farmed for 23 years, and my question is, and I'm searching for answers, we have a small farm. It's 140 acres, and sadly I had to work off the farm for quite a while to make ends meet, but we did it. But I just need to know, how is a farmer who has equipment that requires oil, diesel fuel, hydraulic fluid, grease, unleaded gas, how are we supposed to keep our equipment going so we can put food on your tables and and trucking industry to take the food across state lines so other families can eat nutritiously. I'd love to find out how I can do that without using fossil fuel. Could you help me understand that, please? Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
Yeah, you ask a really important question because we all eat the foods that you raise. And there's not an easy answer to that, just to be honest about that. There are farming practices, and you're probably aware of them and doing what you can and looking for them, that can reduce your fossil fuel consumption. But it's an area that is going to have to be really deeply thought about. What can we do for farmers as we make this transition? Now, on the other end, not dealing with carbon emissions is going to pose a huge problem for farmers also, and already is, when you're bouncing between drought and floods and not knowing, what the climate's going to do, the weather is harder to predict. That has a cost on farmers too, and so I deeply respect what you say, and we're working really hard to figure out, well, what can we do to help the farmers through that transition? It may not be directly through a revenue-neutral carbon tax, but it may be that some other things need to come into play to help that.
Mm-hmm. And that requires, I mean, on so many levels, these are deep changes that you're talking about, the movement to a green economy. We may use that phrase and think of it to actually move to a green economy. It would be and is a very substantial change in this country and would take some time.
Yeah, there are actually some wonderful opportunities for some farmers also in terms of wind turbines on their property or solar.
Mm-hmm.
And programs, in Texas, these farmers dealing with drought, some of them have been basically just saved by the fact that they've been able to put up massive numbers of wind turbines and ranch in between them. When you have a wind turbine on your property, you make money on that.
Thank you so much, Wayne, for your call. We'll take more in a moment. One line is open if you've been trying to reach us. We're talking about what citizens are doing to address the issue of climate change. Earlier, we spoke about a letter that was signed and given to the president of Harvard asking for that university to divest from fossil fuel industry in terms of their endowment money that's in that area. They said you either invest or you divest, and divestment is an important strategy. It's worked for other major issues, tobacco and South Africa. Apartheid in South Africa, so let's do it for fossil fuels. And joining us this part of the show is Madeline Parra. She is from Madison. She's a national program director of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and they are building support across the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, everybody, for decisive national climate protection legislation. She launched the Madison chapter 3 years ago, created several more in the state of Wisconsin. Today there are 8 chapters, and they're just springing up all over the place pretty rapidly, all over the country and also in Canada. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Madeline Parra, this hour, National Program Director for the Citizens Climate Lobby. Tom in Madison is our next caller. Hello, Tom.
Good afternoon. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question about what a revenue neutral tax is, a carbon tax. How does that work?
I'm so glad you asked that question because I hadn't gotten to that yet. So the idea of revenue neutral is that, yes, the government collects money through the fee on carbon emissions. And what happens to that money? And what we propose is that all of that money be returned back to American households equally. And what that does is it supports people as they go through this energy transition that we were talking about, because when the fossil fuel prices go up, that's difficult for folks. But they're going to get a rebate check, basically, under our proposal, that for two-thirds of households would be as much or more than their increased costs. And this has this, so this is useful, this is helpful to just ordinary citizens as we deal with this transition. It's also politically very helpful because for conservatives who don't want to see government grow, the revenue neutral piece is absolutely essential.
Thank you so much for your call, Tom. Mike in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I have a somewhat of a different alternative. Rather than taxing people, which it would essentially be through a fuel tax, would be regressive, being hardest on the people that live on minimum wage, et cetera, who don't have a great income. What my proposal would do would be to reward those individuals and families throughout the state or country who don't drive as much as normal and who don't fly at all. Both those things. Transportation is basically the second most leading greenhouse gas emitter. And then the third part would be to reward households who use less energy, drive fuel in their homes, like less electricity or natural gas, or if they're on solar, for example, they get the maximum amount. And I've got tables for each of those three major activities that would be essentially scaled to the how conservative people were in their use of fuels.
Okay, what do you think of that, Madeline?
I think that conservation is incredibly important, and promoting that is key. It makes a huge difference in lowering emissions. It's the low-hanging fruit. In many ways, it's its own reward because it has a good payback. I would like to encourage the caller to keep thinking in that direction. Getting it through Congress could be pretty difficult. There's this common sense that a tax would be regressive. One of the interesting things is that we had a study commissioned on what would be the effect on the economy of a carbon tax. And they looked first in Massachusetts and then in California, and later this year it will come out for the whole country. But it actually was shown that as long as the revenues are returned back to the economy, that it's going to create jobs and be a plus to the economy to make this transition and put a carbon tax in place. So we thought that was really good news, and also good news for lower-income folks.
Thanks so much for the call. When you meet with members of Congress and editorial boards, do you find that you're still at a basic level of education of talking about the urgency of this issue, talking about our reliance on fossil fuels and what's already happening to the earth right now? Or is it a given that most people understand that?
That's a really great question. We have a national conference every year in June where all of us, as many of us as can, go to D.C. And so I've been doing this since 2011. And in the first year that we were there, we were doing a fair amount of basic education, somewhat about climate change and absolutely about the idea of a revenue-neutral carbon tax. It was an idea that most of them were unfamiliar with. And then 2011 was such an extreme weather year, and 2012, that when we went back the next summer, the conversation had totally shifted.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. People on both sides of the aisle were much more interested to talk with us about, so what is this idea? What are you up to? It had gone from being non-existent as an issue to something that was on their plate. Actually, to the whole extent that at one point President Obama said, I am not promoting a carbon tax, which you could think I would be disappointed about, but I wasn't. The fact that he had to say that said the conversation had moved forward hugely, and I'm quite confident if it ever got to his desk or when it gets to his desk that he would actually support it, but at this stage it's not time for him to do that. So these conversations have really changed a lot. It's not uniform. There are still places where we're coming in and talking the basics, but because what our philosophy is that we're there to build a relationship, not come one time, but keep coming back and really get to know the aides who are so key. And so when we're in there, what we're trying to learn from them through listening is what do they know, what do they get, what do they care most about, and how can we link our issue of climate change to what they already care about. Is mm-hmm. it national security? Well, let's talk about what the generals are saying because they're pretty powerful on it. Is it faith? We've got a lot of faith statements on climate change. Is it hunting and fishing? We can talk about that. You know, and so we tailor what we're saying and help them. We would want to be resources to them and just keep coming back and coming back. And so that's one of my sources of hope, actually, is having seen a shift in the response that we get when we go to the Hill every year.
Thank you, Mike. Let's go to Ryan in McGregor, Iowa. Hi, Ryan. Ryan? Oh, I'm sorry. I've got the wrong line here. There we go. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for the call. I just had a question on the tax that you had mentioned earlier. I heard a little bit earlier, and I was wondering if that was more consumer-based or producer-based for the energy, and what would be to stop the producer from passing on the cost to the consumers, because as we've seen with gas prices and other products in the recent decade, people just adapt to the cost and fit it into their budget.
Yeah, so the tax would be leveled on the producers. So when it comes out of the ground at the mine, at the wellhead, or when it comes into the country. So the producers or the importers would pay. It's a simple calculation. How much CO2 is going to be emitted by that coal they just dug out? It gets paid to the Department of Revenue. And then rebated back to the American public. So, yes, they will pass that on. And that's why we want to start it low and build it up gradually, because we don't want to shock people. And so in the first year, we propose $15 per ton of carbon dioxide, and that would be about a 15-cent rise at the pump in the price of gas. Given the other swings in gas, that's not going to throw us too badly, you know. But you're going to know as you plan your purchases that that's going to be changing over time.
And we go to Jean next in Madison. Hi, Jean.
Hello. Am I on?
You are. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you. I guess my question. I understand the idea of going to, you know, working with Congress, and you mentioned that they need to hear the groundswell from their constituents. And I guess I just wondered, especially for, you know, some of the more conservative Congress people, what do you do about the constituents getting a lot of their information from sources who are scoffing at the idea of global warming?
This is where we have a lot of work to do. Basically, we need to be talking to our neighbors and talking to people who don't always agree with us, and figuring out how to put what we're trying to say in terms that make sense to them. So following the kind of work that, like, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe's been doing in talking to evangelical Christians, she is able to reach them, and therefore we should be able to also, is what I would say. But we do have a lot of work to do that.
And thank you so much for your call, Jean. Our thanks to you. It was an interesting hour, Madeline. Thank you so much. Keep us up to date on what it is you're doing.
I will be glad to do that, and thank you so much for having me on the show. It was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, our pleasure. Madeline Parra, our guest this hour, national program director for the Citizens Climate Lobby. We spent the hour talking about what citizens are doing, and they are urging Congress to enact a revenue-neutral federal carbon tax to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. She has an interesting background. She read James Hansen. We had him on the show a couple of years ago now, I think, who wrote in 2009 a book about climate change. She read it, Storms of My Grandchildren, the book. She left her job as a teacher, and she went to volunteer and eventually joined the small national staff. It's getting larger as we speak. Earlier this hour, the story caught our attention last week when the Harvard University, many members of the faculty, wrote a letter to the president asking for Harvard to divest funds, endowment funds, in the fossil fuel industry. Dr. James Recht, one of the people who started that whole campaign. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll talk about TV comedians. So please stay with us.